Charles Bukowski's Love is a Dog from Hell stands as one of the most brutally honest explorations of love and loneliness in American literature. Since its publication in 1977, this raw collection has become a cult classic, passed between lovers and loners alike, dog-eared and wine-stained. Celebrities from Tom Waits to Johnny Depp have cited Bukowski as a major influence, with his unflinching portrayal of life's underbelly resonating across generations. Unlike the polished poetry of his contemporaries, Bukowski's work reads like whiskey-soaked confessions, immediate, unfiltered, and painfully authentic. His influence extends beyond literature into music, film, and counterculture, offering a voice to those who feel marginalized by conventional society. In Love is a Dog from Hell, we witness a man wrestling with desire and disappointment, creating beauty from the debris of broken relationships and shattered dreams. Bukowski's exploration of love begins with brutal honesty about its transactional nature. In Sandra, he describes a 32-year-old woman who parades silent blonde zeros of young flesh before him, young boys who obey her commands. Despite her beauty, he hopes she finds someone whose heart she can break. This cynical view of relationships as power struggles recurs throughout the collection. The poet doesn't spare himself from scrutiny either. In You, a lover describes his body in unflattering terms: big white belly, hairy feet, fat red nose, yet still desires him sexually, calling him a beast before tenderly asking what he wants for breakfast. This juxtaposition of the grotesque and the tender defines Bukowski's approach to intimacy. Physical connection offers temporary salvation. In The Six-Foot Goddess, he describes a woman who deals in real estate and art, flying between Texas and his home for passionate encounters. Their raw physicality transforms into something tender as they lie locked like human vines. Her blessed eyes run deep into her head like mountain springs. In these rare moments, Bukowski admits she has saved him from everything that is not here. Yet he remains wary. In I've Seen Too Many Glazed-Eyed Bums, he compares love to predatory animals consuming each other, wondering which lover will eat the other first, physically, and last, spiritually. From past experience, he concludes that while she might destroy him physically, he'll be the one destroyed spiritually. The mathematics of love in Bukowski's world is clear. Passion plus time equals pain. In Sex Pot, he portrays a hypersexual woman who carried sex around with her like something in a paper bag, constantly eyeing other men. Eventually, she fell down inside of her sexual organs and vanished, leaving the narrator to recover through absurd coping mechanisms, tap dancing, and wearing a black felt hat. Even when relationships offer moments of peace, Bukowski maintains emotional distance. In Sweet Music, he describes a woman who brings him boiled eggs in bed and listens to classical music with him. When she stays for two nights and asks when she'll see him again, he remains non-committal, nodding as Mozart plays. The emotional economy of Bukowski's world allows for brief connections, but never complete surrender. Throughout the collection, women appear as both saviors and destroyers, objects of desire and sources of pain. In Texan, Bukowski describes a 103-pound Texan with oceans of magical reddish hair cascading down to her ass. She cleans his apartment, cooks healthy meals, and makes him laugh daily. Looking like a young Katharine Hepburn, her presence fills his body completely, and he simply answers yes to her every frustration. Yet this salvation is always temporary. In The Spider, Bukowski compares a former lover to a black widow, her deadly web and embrace that kills nearly claiming him as another victim. He escaped only because she was distracted by too many other males, and now observes other webs from a distance, almost missing the deadly thrill of her embrace. The poet's relationships follow a predictable pattern of intensity followed by dissolution. In The Drill, he contemplates how human relationships simply don't endure while lying in bed with a divorced woman. He places his leg against hers, wondering if someday he'll be the one coming back for my Bermuda shorts and classical record album, standing outside a door that once welcomed me. Women in Bukowski's poetry exist in extremes. They are either idealized or demonized, rarely portrayed with nuance. In an almost made-up poem, he writes to a woman he never met but corresponded with, who wrote insane poems about angels and God and boasted of famous artist lovers. When she commits suicide, he reflects, "If we had met, we might have been unfair to each other. It was best like this." The collection reveals Bukowski's pattern of attraction to damaged women. In Quiet, Clean Girls in Gingham Dresses, he laments that he's only known whores, ex-prostitutes, and mad women, while seeing men with gentle, peaceful women everywhere. He can visualize a good woman's presence, pillows for her head, her slippers on the floor, petting a cat, yet somehow only damaged women find me. Even when he finds someone who seems perfect, like the redhead who appears in multiple poems, the relationship inevitably collapses. In Melancholia, he schedules 15 minutes to grieve for the lost redhead, feeling cleansed afterward, though nothing is solved. The redhead was just another smash in a lifelong loss. Sex in Bukowski's world is rarely romantic. It's a battleground where power dynamics play out in raw, often uncomfortable ways. In One of the Hottest, he describes an encounter with an older woman wearing a platinum blonde wig, face rouged and powdered. Though her neck is wrinkled, she still had the ass of a young girl and good legs. He takes her standing up while the TV flickers, thinking he was fucking the grave, bringing the dead back to life. The poet's descriptions of sexual encounters are deliberately crude, emphasizing physical mechanics over emotional connection. In Like a Flower in the Rain, he details how he cut my middle fingernail short and began rubbing her cunt until she begins getting wet and open like a flower in the rain. Later, they joke about the lotion, cigarette, and apple before getting takeout food, a rare moment of post-coital ease. Often, sex becomes a power struggle or obligation rather than pleasure. In Fuck, he describes a reluctant encounter at a party. Now we've gotta do it. Trapped idiots at a party. Under the sheets, with her panties still on, she expects a performance while he wonders, why she's with me? Where are the other guys? The act becomes like establishing credibility with the taxman, a transaction devoid of joy. Bukowski's sexual frankness shocked readers in the 1970s and continues to challenge contemporary sensibilities. In The End of a Short Affair, he attempts to make love standing up, which doesn't usually work. When his partner wraps her 138-pound body around my middle, pain shoots up his spine at climax. The relationship ends shortly after, leading him to conclude, "Love dries up even faster than sperm." The poet's sexual encounters often involve power imbalances, age differences, economic disparities, or emotional manipulation. In The Night I Fucked My Alarm Clock, he recalls standing at his third-floor window watching a beautiful blonde girl kiss a young man hungrily in their second-floor kitchen. Frustrated and alone, he takes his alarm clock to bed and fucked it until the hands dropped off, a tragicomic image of desperate loneliness. Despite the crudity, Bukowski occasionally reveals vulnerability in sexual situations. In Defeat, he contemplates why he's not devastated by his latest breakup, realizing he's known too many women, and instead of jealousy, thinks she's giving some other poor son of a bitch much trouble right now. After so many failed relationships, he finds himself alone without being alone, and concludes simply, "Look, I've won." Bukowski cultivates the persona of an outsider throughout the collection, positioning himself against literary establishments and social conventions. In This Poet, he tells the story of a drunk poet who vomited inside a grand piano before giving his reading. Though universities blacklisted him, Bukowski defends him, noting he's just like the rest of us, he'll vomit anywhere for money. This anti-establishment stance extends to his views on literary success. In What They Want, he catalogs famous artists' tragic ends: Vallejo starving, Van Gogh's rejected ear, Rimbaud's syphilis, Hemingway's suicide, concluding that audiences want a goddamned show, a lit billboard in the middle of hell, rather than art itself. Bukowski's outsider status is reinforced by his living conditions and neighborhood. In A Neighborhood of Murder, he describes helicopters circling overhead, searching for blood, their searchlights leering into our bedroom. Though five neighbors have pistols and another a machete, they each have small green plants in our windows and leave dishes of food on our porches that disappear by morning. Small gestures of humanity amid violence. The poet's relationship with his literary reputation is ambivalent. In Up Your Yellow River, he responds to rumors of his death and criticism that he could no longer write by asserting that even this casual poem is better than anything those gravediggers could produce. In 462-0614, he describes receiving calls from people who claim to understand his writing but are disappointed when he admits he has no secret to share. Bukowski's anti-hero persona extends to his advice for aspiring writers. In How to Be a Great Writer, he sardonically recommends having unhappy love affairs, hemorrhoids and bad teeth, drinking cheap wine, avoiding opera, golf, and chess, and keeping moving your bed. He urges writers to hit that typewriter hard, like a heavyweight fight, remembering literary heroes like Hemingway and Dostoevsky who suffered in tiny rooms without women, food, or hope. Despite his outsider stance, Bukowski reveals occasional vulnerability about his reputation. In Photographs, he describes photographers with astonishingly big asses coming to take his picture. This playing at author feels like real Hemingway, James Joyce stage shit. Yet he acknowledges that behind him are the books I've written, proof I've done something, even without Paris. As Bukowski approaches his mid-50s during the writing of this collection, mortality becomes an increasingly present theme. In Clean Old Man, he wonders, what will I write about when it no longer stands up in the morning? He imagines his critics will love it when my playground narrows down to tortoises and shell stars, perhaps even saying nice things about me, as if I had finally come to my senses. The physical indignities of aging appear throughout the collection. In 225 pounds, he describes using his weight to subdue a much younger woman during an argument. I roll my 225 pounds on top of her to subdue her. The contrast between his aging body and her youth becomes a source of both power and insecurity. Time's passage is marked through changing sexual capabilities and opportunities. In How Come You're Not Unlisted, he reflects on his late-blooming sex life. For a man of 55 who didn't get laid until 23 and not often until 50, I should stay listed until I get as much as the average man. His phone number remains public specifically to facilitate encounters with women who call him after reading his work. Bukowski contemplates his mortality directly in When I Think of Myself Dead, imagining automobiles parked in lots, frying pans, somebody making love to you when I'm not around. The mundane details, I won't be able to drink water anymore, make death's approach more tangible than philosophical abstractions. The poet's relationship with his aging body is complex. In As Crazy as I Ever Was, he declares that despite being told he's famous, he's still drunk and writing poems at 3 a.m., wondering, what counts now is one more tight pussy before the light tilts out. He insists he hasn't changed. I'm as crazy as I ever was. They don't understand I haven't stopped hanging out of fourth-floor windows by my heels. Yet there are moments of acceptance. In Bedpans, he confronts the indignities of hospital deaths, hard under your ass as you're dying, expected to sit up on this impossible thing to relieve yourself, with dark humor and resignation. The hardest part of dying, he concludes, is that they expect you to go out like a rocket, but the means of escape are unavailable. Los Angeles emerges as a character in its own right throughout the collection, with its particular blend of beauty and squalor, opportunity and disappointment. In The Good Life, Bukowski describes a communal house where 7 or 8 people scrape together rent while roaches crawl over shirt buttons, and everyone sleeps everywhere at once, floors, couches, bathtubs, even in the brush outside. The city's margins provide both material and perspective for the poet. In The Girls at the Green Hotel, he observes prostitutes who outshine movie stars, lounging on the lawn, sunbathing. Traffic nearly stops to look at one sitting in a short dress with high heels, legs crossed, exposing miraculous thighs. They are whores without souls, magical because they never lie about what they are. Bukowski's Los Angeles is populated by eccentric characters. In Private First Class, he laments the arrest of his neighborhood character, a black man in an L.A. Rams sweatshirt with cut-off sleeves who occasionally stole babies but always returned them unharmed. He slept behind the love parlor where the girls showed him compassion, but now he's gone, and the poet worries his taxes will rise to house and feed him in state custody. The urban landscape offers both isolation and unexpected beauty. In The Strangest Sight You Ever Did See, Bukowski witnesses from his DeLongpre window a makeshift skateboard contraption, roller skates nailed to a longboard with all their possessions tied down. A thin white southerner pulls it by ropes while a beautiful black woman in yellow dress and turban pushes from behind, her face gloriously indifferent. As they pass, he shouts, "Don't worry, somebody will rent us a place," and the poet thinks, "They're going to make it." Even in decay, the city offers moments of grace. In A Plate Glass Window, he describes eating around 2:30 in the afternoon, where all the people are addled but glad to be alive, eating near a plate glass window that keeps the outside out. It's good to be somewhere without having your flesh ripped from your bones, and after eating, he stacks everything neatly. My offering to luck and that sun working good inside the darkness here. The urban environment shapes Bukowski's understanding of human relationships. In Traffic Signals, he observes old people playing a game in a seaside park. Thin, pale man with tight wristwatches, a heavily rouged woman with false eyelashes. They disgust him with their passive waiting for death with as much passion as a traffic signal. These are the dead who believe advertisements, buy dentures on credit, and celebrate holidays. Though less prominent than his romantic relationships, Bukowski's family connections reveal deeper layers of his emotional landscape. In My Old Man, he recalls coming home drunk at 16 during the Depression to find his clothing, suitcase, and short stories thrown onto the front lawn, while his mother would hide behind a tree warning me not to go in. Despite this rejection, his father showed an unexpected moment of connection. One evening, he walked in with pages of Bukowski's short story and said, "This is a great short story." It was about a rich man who fought with his wife, went out for coffee, observed mundane details, then visited his favorite horse, who kicked him dead. Though the poet had no idea what I was writing about, this moment of recognition stands out. I guess that's as close as we ever got. Generational patterns emerge in Bukowski's relationship with his grandfather. In A Gold Pocket Watch, he describes a tall German with a strange smell on his breath, who stood very straight in front of his small house, hated by his wife, thought odd by his children. At 6, Bukowski met him and received all his war medals. The second time, he gave him his gold pocket watch, which I wound too tight and broke. Though his parents said he drank too much, the poet liked him best standing straight, saying, "Hello, Henry, you and I, we know each other." Bukowski's own role as a father appears briefly but significantly. In Sitting in a Sandwich Joint, he declares, "My daughter is glorious." They eat takeout in his car in Santa Monica, and he tells her, "My life has been good, so good." When she laughs at his mock puking gesture, he sneaks a look at her. "We've got all the luck we need." her eyes brilliant with the remainder of day, she's grinning. In One for Old Snaggletooth, he writes about a woman who solves puzzles methodically, lives by the sea, feeds ants sugar, and believes in a better world. Though her eccentricities once irritated him, he realizes she has hurt fewer people than anyone I know, and has persevered through terrible times when I should have helped more. She's the mother of my only child and once my lover, and by hurting fewer people, she has created a better world and won. The poem ends with a dedication to Frances, revealing a rare moment of genuine admiration. These family connections offer glimpses of Bukowski's capacity for tenderness beneath his hardened exterior. In Ashes, when a woman tells her about scattering her partner's ashes at sea, he listens to her grief even while planning his escape from the relationship. These moments of empathy, though fleeting, reveal the poet's understanding of human connection beyond sexual conquest. Despite the collection's overwhelming cynicism, Bukowski occasionally discovers moments of unexpected beauty and transcendence in the midst of squalor. In Dog, he observes, "A single dog walking alone on a hot sidewalk of summer appears to have the power of 10,000 gods. Why is this?" This simple image captures his ability to find significance in overlooked moments. Even in rejection and loneliness, Bukowski creates meaning through his art. In Prayer in Bad Weather, he laments the absence of women who examine a man's body with such care that it softens him, noting that it's not the fucking and sucking alone, it's all the extras. As he listens to rain falling, he acknowledges that rain is good for things that live alone. The poet finds beauty in resilience. In One for the Shoeshine Man, he catalogs what preserves balance in life. Snails climbing cliffs, luck being girls hollering, "Hello, sweetie." The miracle is having 5 women love you at 55, while goodness is loving only one. He acknowledges being bitter sometimes, but the taste has often been sweet, concluding that justice is everywhere and working. Bukowski's appreciation for simple pleasures appears throughout the collection. In Beer, he reflects on how many bottles of beer I've consumed waiting for things to get better, or after splits with women, waiting for phones that never ring and footsteps that never arrive. These rivers and seas of beer accompany him through loneliness, as the radio sings love songs, the phone remains silent, and the walls stand straight up and down. Even mundane moments can offer transcendence. In Sex, he describes watching a teenage girl cross in front of his car, her contours waving as she looks directly at him with purple eyes, then blows the largest pink globe of bubblegum I've ever seen while he listens to Beethoven on the radio. This brief encounter between youth and age, innocence and experience, becomes a moment of unexpected connection. Perhaps most significantly, Bukowski finds beauty in honesty about human suffering. In The Crunch, he acknowledges that people are not good to each other, but adds, "I don't ask them to be, but I think about it." Despite his cynicism, he wonders, perhaps if we were better to each other, our deaths wouldn't be so sad. There must be a way we haven't thought of yet. This glimmer of hope, however faint, suggests that even Bukowski's hardened heart remains open to the possibility of human connection. Love is a Dog from Hell remains one of Charles Bukowski's most powerful collections precisely because it refuses to romanticize love or human connection. Instead, it presents relationships in all their messy, contradictory complexity. Moments of tenderness amid cruelty, flashes of beauty amid squalor, and glimpses of hope amid despair. Bukowski's unflinching honesty about his own flaws and failures gives his work an authenticity that continues to resonate with readers. He doesn't position himself as a hero or moral authority, but as a fellow traveler through life's disappointments and occasional joys. His anti-poetic style, direct, conversational, and often crude, creates an immediacy that more formal poetry often lacks. The collection's enduring power lies in its refusal to offer easy answers or comforting illusions. Love remains a dog from hell, dangerous, unpredictable, capable of both devotion and destruction. Yet Bukowski continues to pursue it despite repeated heartbreak, suggesting that even the most cynical among us cannot entirely abandon the hope for connection. In our increasingly sanitized and curated culture, Bukowski's raw voice reminds us of the value of authenticity over perfection, of honest struggle over pretended ease. His poetry speaks to the parts of ourselves we often hide, our loneliness, our desperation, our capacity for both cruelty and tenderness. By giving voice to these shadow aspects, he paradoxically creates a sense of connection through shared human frailty. Perhaps this is why, decades after its publication, Love is a Dog from Hell continues to find new readers who recognize themselves in Bukowski's unflinching portrait of love and loneliness. In a world increasingly dominated by artificial perfection, his messy, complicated humanity offers something increasingly rare, the truth, however uncomfortable it might be.